From KMXT in Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
Public comment is in for a NOAA Fisheries Management Plan for Cook Inlet's most productive drift fishing waters. In nearly 90 submitted public comments, cities, tribes, trade organizations, and the State Commissioner of Fish and Game expressed mixed and negative reactions to the plan. KDLL's Riley Board has more.
The Cook Inlet Exclusive Economic Zone has been the subject of lawsuits and delayed decisions since 2020. After a federal North Pacific Fishery Management Council chose to take no action when deciding between four management plans for the EEZ last April, NOAA Fisheries published its management plan in October. That plan, called Amendment 16, would see federal management of the EEZ and state management of state waters. The proposal included new rules. Commercial drift gillnet fishing would be allowed for 12-hour periods 2 days a week, from June 19th to August 15th or until catch limits are met, and vessels would not be allowed to participate in both the federal and state fisheries. NOAA also writes that the plan's purpose is to, quote, promote the goals and objectives of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. The agency accepted public comments on the plan through mid-December. Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang submitted a 5-page letter expressing significant concerns with the management plan. He writes that it conflicts with state measures, which include managing the mixed species fishery with the weakest stock in mind, and different open dates for the drift gillnet fishery. He concludes by saying if Amendment 16 is adopted, the state will continue to manage its waters as required by the Alaska Constitution and its regulatory obligations. Commercial fishing organizations were also unhappy with the plan in their comments. The Alaska Salmon Alliance lays out 14 grievances with Amendment 16, like a lack of historic escapement data, a concern of inequitable privileges between different types of fishing, and the splitting of state and federal fisheries. Other commercial fishing groups, including the North Pacific Fisheries Association and Cook Inlet Fishermen's Fund, submitted similar complaints, often highlighting contradictions with the Magnuson-Stevens Act. In the plan, NOAA says sport fishing accounts for about 0.01% of the salmon caught in the EEZ, but sport fishing organizations, including the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association and the American Sport Fishing Association, were still strongly opposed to the plan in their comments, advocating instead for what they characterize as more nuanced state management. The Central Peninsula's federally recognized tribes all submitted letters, many showing disappointment with the lack of subsistence fishery proposed for the EEZ. The Nanilchek Traditional Council writes in its letter that the plan violates the Magnuson-Stevens Act by not accounting for subsistence fishing or the tribes that can participate in it. The Salamatoff tribe also requests the amendment include a subsistence fishery, something the EEZ has not had in the past, describing it as, quote, long overdue. While the city of Kenai submitted a short comment encouraging NOAA to adopt a plan that, quote, benefits all users for generations to come, the city of Soldotna was more specific. In a 3-page letter, Mayor Paul Whitney writes that the city supports Amendment 16 but suggests major changes, including not separating the fishery into state and federally managed sections and not regulating for too high of escapement goals. The State Board of Fisheries is set to discuss the proposed plan at its Upper Cook Inlet Finfish meeting at the end of February. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund. In recognition of the fishing industry, which provides more than 50,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council will be meeting at the Renaissance Hotel in Seattle, Washington, beginning February 5th. Among the many reports they will review is one titled Groundfish Area Closures Within the Bristol Bay Red King Crab Stock Assessment Area. Among the topics for discussion is the degree that midwater or pelagic trawl gear contacts the bottom on the crab grounds with potential harm to crab stocks. Beginning on page 179 of that report is a description of the pelagic trawl gear performance standard. When pelagic gear was first defined in regulation in 1990, it was prohibited from contacting the bottom. But the final rule, published in 1991, removed that prohibition because it was deemed unenforceable. Instead, in 1993, a performance standard was introduced that prohibited a pelagic trawler from having 20 or more crab on deck with a minimum size of 1.5 inches across the back. Data had shown them that halibut bycatch doubled when the 20 crab threshold was reached, suggesting that the trawl was indeed spending time on the bottom at that point. So the 20 crab standard seemed like a neat and simple way to measure bottom contact and potentially apply penalties to discourage it. But the performance standard has also proven to be practically unenforceable. An enforcement officer, or more likely an observer, must count, measure, and document all 20 crab, and they must all be visible at any particular time. Unfortunately, crab are a prohibited species that, by regulation, must be discarded immediately and with minimum damage. It's tough to collect 20 crab at a time when you're supposed to be constantly tossing them over. Also, sampling is done at the cod end only, but reports indicate that crab are more often caught in other parts of the net. Plus, there's no handy box to check in their paperwork packet for the performance standard. They must write and submit a special statement alleging a violation. In the 24 years since 1999, only 38 such statements recording 66 potential violations have been submitted. None resulted in any type of monetary penalty. Enforcement action consisted of 4 compliance assistance outreach efforts and 3 written warnings. North Pacific Fishery Management Council meetings can be viewed live by clicking the link on their website or at any time on their YouTube channel.
Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced this month that fishing for yellow-eye is again prohibited in southeast Alaska this year. Yellow-eye are a popular species of rockfish, but their populations dropped in recent years, which has fish and game biologists concerned. As KRBD's Jack Darrell reports, tight fishing regulations could be helping yellow-eye, but it will be a long time before we know for sure.
There are 7 species of demersal shelf rockfish lurking in the depths of southeast Alaska. Quillback, China, copper, canary, rosethorn, tiger rockfish, and yellow-eye. According to Fish and Game, all of them have experienced population decline in recent years. But among all of them, yellow-eye is the most common and the most sought after. The Fish and Game announcement earlier this month isn't a change. The commercial fishery in southern southeast Alaska for demersal shelf rockfish closed in 2020. The fishery in the northern part of the region shuttered in 1995. In the intervening years, the Board of Fish has added restrictions to sport and recreational fishers as well. All DSR species are still fair game for southeast subsistence fishers. Non-residents fishing in any capacity are banned from retaining any demersal shelf rockfish. New harvest regulations are looser than in previous years. In 2021, retaining any DSR was illegal for recreational fishermen. This year, Ketchikan residents can take home up to 3 rockfish, as long as none of them are yellow eyes. Chris Baldwin has run a charter fishing boat for over a decade. He says he supports the continued closure.
So we support regulations. If Fish and Game thinks that they're declining, they need to be protected.
Baldwin says it's not rare, though, for the big orange fish to end up as bycatch for a halibut or lingcod angler.
And so it also presents a challenge when you get those big yellow eyes to descend them, because we're required to descend them if we don't want to retain them, or if we can't retain them.
Rockfish live their whole lives near the seafloor. Baldwin says when they are yanked to the surface by a fishing line, the nitrogen in their body expands, making them buoyant. This greatly reduces their chance of returning to deep water or surviving the encounter. That's why the Board of Fish required all sport and charter fishermen to have a descending device on board.
It hits a certain pressure and just opens up, so you clamp it around the mouth. I hook it to my downrigger and drop it down, and then it releases the fish.
Yellow eye, so named for their prominent yellow eyes, make their homes among the rocks deep below the surface. With their spiny dorsal fin, bright orange, yellow, and red coloring, they sort of resemble an underwater fireball. They're a popular catch among sport fishermen because of their look, size, and according to Baldwin, they put up a good fight.
They definitely fight differently than other types of rockfish.
They're also one of the longest living fish species in the world, sometimes surviving to be well over 100 years old, until their Southeast Alaska populations went into freefall. Alex McCarroll is a biologist with Fish and Game. She says that since yellow eye often live for so long, they grow slowly and mature late, meaning that fishing them on a season-by-season basis can have a major effect on the health of the population. This also means getting the fish back to a healthy level may take longer than other overfished species.
So we don't know for sure, but it could be a combination of environmental factors, like the blob that happened in the North Pacific, as well as fishing pressures and their life history characteristics. Yellow-eyed rockfish are particularly vulnerable because they're long-lived species.
The blob was a marine heat wave that occurred in the 2010s, a mass of warm water in the North Pacific Ocean that persisted for nearly 3 years and had a pronounced negative effect on sea creatures like rockfish. Rhea Ayersman leads ADF&G's groundfish monitoring efforts in Southeast. She says they measure demersal shelf rockfish with remotely operated vehicles on the seafloor, as well as data from bycatch in the commercial halibut fishery.
So that's how we survey yellow-eyed rockfish to come up with a density estimate, which gets expanded out to biomass estimate. So we're doing these surveys that are feeding into stock assessments.
Just before the 2020 fishery closure, Fish and Game report a 60% decline in yellow-eyed biomass since the mid-90s. Fish and Game says they will continue monitoring the species with hopes for reopening the fishery in the future. Until then, fishermen will have to continue to descend them back to the deep. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen, providing twice-weekly service to Alaska's Emerald Isle.